the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Mainstream investors are wrong more often than right. Most folks intuitively know this, and statistics and studies back it up. How can you buck the trend and be right more often than wrong? Joining me on the program is author Ken Fisher. His new book is called Beat the Crowd, How You Can Outvest the Herd by Thinking Differently. Ken, in your book, you talk about contrary thinking has been a theme that has run throughout many of your books that you have written, but you never overtly addressed it. So in this book, you wanted to address the issue. In your opinion, it's more about independent thinking. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. When I was young a long time ago in a world far, far away, contrarianism was generally thought of then as try to figure out what the crowd's thinking and think that the reverse will happen. In theory, what should happen is what consensus agrees on should be priced into markets and therefore should not occur. But beyond that, theoretically, anything could happen. And the traditional notion of contrarianism seems to me in this day and age to be flat wrong, because it's easier and easier and easier to see the consensus through the internet, to see what people tend to agree on, to be able to build up consensus metrics. And therefore, today there's always the herd, and then there's what I call the anti-herd herd, or the folks that are set up to be the reverse of the herd. So there's really two herds. And what that really tells you, in my view, is that you figure out what people think and you figure out the people that are opposed to that and what they think, and then some other thing happens. So figuring those first two out allows you to improve the odds as you contemplate other possibilities. Another way to say that is simply that if everybody thinks the market will be up in a given year, 40 years ago, a contrarian would have said, so I think it'll be down. Today, when everybody says it'll be up, you can kind of metric how much they think it'll be up, and that's pretty easy to do today. And then it'll either be up a lot more, or it'll be up a lot less, or it will be negative. And all of those are possible, because what it probably won't be is the exact reverse of what people thought.
You know, there's a real battle today. If you really want to be an independent thinker, as you talk about in your book, you have to battle the financial blogosphere. You got websites and TV. One of the problems I think investors have today, Ken, and I'm even talking about professionals here, you go back 30, 40 years ago, you had three network television networks that you could watch, and you had the one dominant newspaper in your town. That's not the world we live in today. We've got tweets, we've got blogospheres, websites, cable TV, everything. You believe you need to train your mind and brain to battle the media, the crowd, your friends, your neighbors, and learn to think differently. So, I mean, you have multiple sources that are trying to feed input to you that you've got to ward off and step back from.
Let me speak to that differently. In that earlier world, the world that people lived in nearly forever, you had then magazines that you received in the mail, which were a few weeks old when you got them, that had been planned a few weeks before that. And you might have had a little bit of radio, but not the talk radio we have today nonstop. Today, I mean, literally, if you were interested last night, you could see the State of the Union address in writing before he delivered it, which is very different from once upon a time where people would have gathered around the television to listen to the president deliver the State of the Union. And today we are not only bombarded by so much, but we're also bombarded by sources that we do not know if they are credible or not. And in fact, the most credible of them have become less credible because they're competing in this boiling cauldron of media to try to get things to you right here, right now, so fast that they don't actually have time with good intent to be very careful or very accurate. And the dilemma with all of that is that it confuses us. It bewilders us. Sorting through it is problematic, and it makes us less confident, less slow moving, more myopic, more prone to think that little market movements are terribly important, that little things we read about bombarding us online that we got at 10:30 last night are terribly important and that we should pay attention to. It's as if you don't even have time to sleep anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you also talk about, too, there's a lot of decisions, maxims, things such as confirmation bias that the media spends a lot of time on. I mean, there's quotes out there, sell them, go away, come back after Labor Day. I mean, there's, you know, the January effect, all these kind of things that you also have to deal with that are sort of like these rules that are out there that sort of hang around and people often refer to them.
Well, A, that's true. B, I've been guilty of using many such things in my life myself. My debunkery book a few years ago specifically took to task most of those that you mentioned and a lot more. But if you just take a look at the year we're in right now, there is so much that I think is inexplicable to so many people, like how can a guy like Don Trump, that's never run for anything, ever be number one on the Republican side? How can Hillary Clinton be seen as the front runner on the Democratic side when she's running behind Bernie Sanders in the early state? What will happen? How do we understand this? How do we explain it? You'll see the rule of thumb that people will say, which is partly true and partly false. For example, relative to this year's presidential election, that the Electoral College is biased in favor of the Democrats. But if you look at state houses in the country, and if the state houses that were all red today voted Republican for president, you couldn't possibly elect a Democrat president of the United States in the Electoral College because it swings the other way around. All of the rules of thumb have a counterpoint. And the key is to kind of see that the more this stuff is perceived, the more you need to think through the counter argument. And let me just take that one that I mentioned. I think very few people see in a world where the media will tell you endlessly things like the rise of the independent voter that is neither Republican nor Democrat, which is true. The voter today calls himself or herself independent. They do not so much call themselves Republicans or Democrats, though they used to. But if I call myself a blind monkey that's an illegal alien from outer space, that doesn't make me that. It just is what I call myself. And in fact, if you actually look at the way the country votes, it votes very differently than that. And much of what we get today, going back to the original question that you asked, we have difficulty with because America has a couple of different countries in it at the same time, and only one of them is very urban, and the very urban one is the one that the media reflects, and the non-urban one the media doesn't really understand and reflect much at all, and that's half of American life today.
Let's talk about an example of this, and especially now with the movie The Big Short out there, the financial crisis, 2008. What people didn't focus on, and you write about this in your first chapter, is an little statement or an accounting rule, FAS 157, the fair value measurement, how that impacted the financial crisis. Could we talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So there was FAS 157 and then its non-US counterpart, IASB 157, both of which did the exact same thing, which is to force banks to do mark-to-market accounting for the illiquid securities that were collateralized mortgage obligations, whether residential or commercial. And in that process, there's no actual way to do that correctly because there's no market to mark them to. So whatever somebody else wrote them down to, because of the interplay of this law or any other law with Sarbanes-Oxley, the CEOs and CFOs of the publicly traded companies, in this case, primarily the big banks and investment banks, would be criminally and civilly liable if they were found to have material earnings deficiencies from not moving fast enough. They just got into a musical chairs game of writing down the assets, writing down the assets, writing down the assets, which took down their statutory book value, which took down their ability to make loans. And the total aggregate of that globally was $2 trillion plus. And that $2 trillion is the piece of the puzzle that nobody can understand in real time. It's the part that's the tipping point. And still today, people don't understand that, in that if you look at a 70 plus trillion dollar global GDP that's normally growing without inflation at a couple of percent a year, you need new big bad things of at least a couple of trillion bucks to turn an expanding economy into a recession. The fact of the matter is, a few hundred billion dollars here and a few hundred billion dollars there sounds like, as Everett Dirksen once upon a time would have said, real money. But it's not enough to get you there. You need literally trillions of dollars of new big bad in today's global economy. And that was the elephant. That was the trillions of dollars of new big bad that nobody saw coming at the marketplace, which which just imploded the bank's abilities to make loans. And yet today we perceive the banks as solely bad guys. And you could hear that in the president's State of the Union address last night. And in fact, in reality, this accounting rule, which was little noted at the time, happened just before the beginning of the bear market and was obliterated by the SEC as a law just a couple of weeks after the end of the bear market. Otherwise, we could have still kept writing all that stuff down all the way to zero. It's a bottomless pit of regulatory demise.
Isn't that what part of the recovery, too? Wasn't it in March or something when they got rid of that in 2009?
Yes, it was just 2 weeks after the March 9th bottom in 2009 that they got rid of that. It went into place just before the market peaked in 2007, and it was obliterated by SEC fiat in later March of 2009, just after the bear market bottomed. Again, quite simply, this set of rules, which sounded good to them when they put it in place, was a bottomless pit. And one of the sad parts about regulatory, and it was done with good intent. There was never any bad intent in these kinds of things. But, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And that good intent, quite simply, was a bottomless pit that, because it linked a non-market event to any other write down you could see, if somebody else wrote something down, your obligation was to write yours down lower. Then somebody else would see yours and they'd have to write theirs down lower. And if they didn't do that, and there was a material loss on your books at the end of the day, you could and might be found criminally and civilly liable. It's a tremendous irony in today's world that there's so many people that want to go back and say, why weren't bankers and investment bankers put in jail? Well, the reason a lot of bankers and investment bankers weren't put in jail is because they were neither accused nor convicted of a felony. And that's kind of central to the process. And they're actually pretty good at making sure they don't do that. And they're pretty thoughtful about those things to make sure that doesn't happen, because not very many people really want to go to jail, particularly people in those kind of positions, and they're surrounded by lawyers. And that process literally leads us in a circumstance like that to hell. It's a point that we don't often see, and nobody saw at the time. I didn't see it as it was happening. I didn't see it until October of 2008, and by then it's almost over. It's a funny part of our world, because regulations which are not voted on by Congress, or in some other country a similar way by a legislature, signed by a president or whatever, are ones that we don't really see vetted in front of us, therefore aren't discounted into pricing in the marketplace, and can have huge negative repercussions. That surprised the heck out of me at the time, and in my mind is relatively unprecedented. The other parallel point that I talk about in that book, which I think is unprecedented in history, is that the banks and investment banks that stepped in to do roles that they always did at the request of regulators, which was to help bail out the troubled ones, those that raised their hands to volunteer and be the good guys are the ones that then came and were whacked later by the government. And the penalties of the volunteers versus the penalties for the non-volunteers after the fact is a staggering phenomena, which said to all of the big banks and investment banks that are still standing, the next time there's a debacle, don't raise your hand and volunteer to help. Stand out of the way, let other people do it, because if you volunteer to help, they're going to whack you. And so next time, we're not going to get them willing to step forward and do things like the takeover of Countrywide, or J.P. Morgan taking over Bear Stearns, or because the more you volunteered to help, the more they whack you.
I want to come back to that in your chapter on politics. I want to talk about professional groupthink, and especially forecasters. Here we are. It's the beginning of the year. Forecasts are out from Wall Street. The general consensus is it's going to be a year of great volatility. The market isn't going to do much. Expect low gains on stocks and a lot of volatility. That seems to be the consensus. Let's talk about professional groupthink, because that's exactly what we experienced last year. The market did little of anything. In fact, lost a little ground. One market was up like the NASDAQ, but we had a lot of volatility in the markets. And here we are, the beginning of the year, the same forecast and volatility in the markets. So what does one think when you look at that standing back? How do you assess that?
Well, in books of mine going back some years, I've advocated that you, at the end of the year, collect professional forecasters' forecasts for the year ahead and array them in kind of a bell curve-like pattern, and that the middle of that bell curve pretty much never, ever happens, because these people are people who are avid collectors of information. They interact with the world, or are the world, or both, that place the bet. And therefore, they are that which has been discounted into pricing in the time frame that markets discount, which is out about 12 months, and maybe a little more, maybe a little less. So that forecast range of lukewarm. Now, you said, and I'm being cute here, but you said, you know, great volatility. I think all volatility is great. I just think it's marvelous. You meant a lot of volatility. And again, volatility comes and goes, but you don't get an up a lot market without volatility, and you don't get a down a lot market without volatility. People only think of the down part as volatile, whereas the up part is also volatile. But with those forecasts that you see of median expected return of 7.5% for this year, looking at global forecasts for U.S. and global markets, I'd say categorically that the market is either up a lot or it's a flattish to negative market, and you have to take your choices as to which you think it is. But because I think volatility is normal, not exceptional, and stocks just move a lot, and the potential for a 10% quarter is always up or down is always there, you could easily still see after the down start to the year a 30% year. And to that point, I make the point that as we speak, there's been a lot of news about how bad last week was in the stock market. But in fact, last week was only a little bit worse than the first week in 1998, which ended the year up 28%. And that's just the nature of equities being volatile. They bounce around a lot. People tend to want to read too much today into myopic short-term movement.
I want to move on, and you talk about the flawed financial eyesight of the media. Sometimes what seems important or pressing that the markets are focusing on, and this goes to something that we see now with the advent of financial cable stations where you have 24-hour financial news. But the media puts a lot of emphasis on an individual economic report. I think things, as you point out in your book, like the leading economic indicators, which is more encompassing, tells a more complete story than, let's say, a single employment report.
Well, that's true. That's categorically true, but it's got a weakness to it, which is that helps you figure out what the economy is going to do. It doesn't so much help you figure out what the stock market's going to do, because the stock market itself, of course, is one of the best leading indicators in developed nations, which is where it matters, are in every country's leading economic index. The fact of the matter is that, as the book points out at some length in two chapters devoted to this, markets don't really care about the short term, and they don't really care about the very long term. Markets care about the next approximate 3 to 30 months. And anything much further out than that, simply they disbelieve, whether it's going to be true or not. They'll worry about it when it gets closer. If it's shorter term than that, people will chatter about it, and they'll claim that volatility is associated with it, but it's just volatility. It's not the direction of the market. Markets discount the approximate next 3 to 30 month activities. And so today we get all of this chatter, and the media is usually focused on either very short-term phenomena, what's right here in front of our face that has little to no market import, or things that are way far out into the future, like the bankruptcy of Social Security or climate change or the kids are no good or whatever. So you can get these tremendous interests, partially because they attract eyeballs and they're sensationalistic and people like to read about them, and they might actually be very important in non-market ways. And I'm not suggesting that they're not, and I'm not suggesting that any of those long-term or short-term topics aren't of tremendous import to your listeners. But as they relate to figuring out where the market's going, they don't help you at all, and the media just is noise that troubles you and reflects all of that being priced.
I want to talk about, and you have a chapter on this, the next 30 months. Let's talk about that, because there's calls for a crash. There's calls for a recession. As you mentioned, this is a political election year, so the issues on Social Security, Medicare. I can't turn on a cable station with some guy telling me to buy gold because of the national debt, or, you know, I should be fearful. It's raining. It's flooding in California. Global warming.
Yes, all of that's true. And the fact is that global warming and the national debt and all those are things that are beyond the 3 to 30 months. And if you think of the national debt one, for example, without getting into the argument, you couldn't find a year in the last 25 years where that argument wasn't made endlessly. And some of your other points are equally valid, but equally permanent, in that you've always got calls for crashes, and you've always got calls for doom and gloom, and you've always got calls for boom. And the fact of the matter is that the more gloom calls you've got, the less likely it is you actually get gloom, because that's
priced into the market. But the reality of all of that is that few folks are focused on the time period that markets care about, which is the next 3 to 30 months. And let me just give you an example of that. At the point that we're at right now, this year, more than any presidential election that I can recall, we've got quite a lot of uncertainty as we move close to New Hampshire and Iowa, and then on to what really matters, which are the two Super Tuesdays on March 1st and March 15th, where at the conclusion of them on the Republican side, 60% of the delegates will have been decided, whereas only 5% of the delegates will have been decided after New Hampshire and Iowa. The point that I'm making is we're still too early for the market to discount the 3 to 30 month phenomena, which is the election, and even who the candidates will be, which begins to get clearer as we move into the year further down the road. And so we've got a lot of uncertainty. Markets don't like uncertainty. Markets like certainty. We get a lot more certainty as the year progresses. So one of the features about election years that's not widely appreciated, and I'm not going to hang my hat on this and lay my life down on it, but typically as you move through the election year, you get more certainty. And as you get more certainty, markets tend to do better. Are there exceptions to that? Of course, 2008 being a perfect example of that, an exception. But for the most part, unless there's something extraordinary going on that overrides the normalcy of the election cycle, as you move through the election cycle, uncertainty falls away. As uncertainty falls away, markets do better. And in fact, 80% of the time in history, in an election year, the U.S. market does better than the non-U.S. market in the period starting June 1st. Why? Because the market discounts the next 3 to 30 months.
I want to talk about the elephant in the room. Like one of the elephants going back to the financial crisis was that FASB rule that was put into effect that forced all these write-downs that we saw with banks. And of course, it fed on it itself. It's really difficult sometimes when we're bombarded with all kinds of information, as you talk about in the book, whether it's the blogosphere, whether it's cable TV, it's tweets, you name it. How does one stand back and say, all right, here's what everybody's thinking. What should I be looking for that nobody's looking at?
When I answer that question, I've got to say that every general rule I would give you is obviously going to have some exceptions to it. But there's almost no exceptions to the point that we don't go into terrible times when the spread between short-term and long-term interest rates is relatively steep. If you take, for example, in throughout 2008, short-term rates and long-term rates were effectively identical, otherwise known as a flat yield curve. Getting a flat yield curve doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have bad times, but you pretty much never have bad times when the spread between short and long rates is more than about 1%, like it is now and like it is most of the time. The fact is, it's a simple elephant. It's a positive elephant now, but people don't think about that. All those folks that are arguing gloom and doom today are arguing gloom and doom, which is a statement in a sense that it's different this time, which is, of course, a common statement. And as John Templeton famously said, the four most dangerous words in the English language are it's different this time. But the reality is that they're arguing that when the yield curve is nicely, positively sloped upward, meaning that short rates are well below long rates, and you expect doom and gloom, you're asking for something that's pretty much never happened before. And then you look at that and you say, well, maybe that could happen, but you need to find big bad things that aren't priced into the market that everyone isn't talking about. And when you look around, you say to yourself, are people just talking about the things that are, people have been talking about for a long time? And if they are, isn't that priced? And therefore, how does that have market power? Because if everybody's been talking about it, it is priced and it doesn't have future market power. Another one that's one of my rules that I've had for a long time, again, it's not perfect, but it's pretty good, is that when you get into what you consider to be the second half of a bull market and an economic expansion, and particularly the longer it is, the more this is true, that companies with fat gross operating profit margins, that is total revenue minus cost of goods sold, being very fat, meaning typically, you know, 50%-ish or more, tend to do best. There's fundamental reasons for that, but it's also historically true. And so you say to yourself, you want to put yourself in the kinds of places that work best as opposed to trying to get late in the bull market into fancy, cute stories that are too tricky by half. You want to keep it simple. You want to don't swing for the fences. You want singles and doubles more than home runs. And that's another, that fat gross operating profit margin function in the second half of a bull market is another one of those elephant in the rooms that's positive. It flips off to be negative early in a bull market because early in a bull market, it's the thin margin companies that do best. These are all kind of simple things that are in the book that are covered at some length. And again, there's always going to be an exception, as the book talks about at some length. The investing game is one of probabilities. It's not one of certainties. And you're just trying to stack the odds in your favor.
Let's talk about a chapter in your book that you said everybody hates. That's politics. But we are in the middle of a presidential election year. We will be electing a new Congress. We'll be electing a new president. What are the important things that one should glean about politics? A good example that you give is when Obamacare was passed, it was going to be curtains for the healthcare sector. And as we all know, since it passed, it turned out to be one of the best performing sectors.
Yeah. So simply going back to something that I said a few moments ago, markets hate uncertainty. And as uncertainty fades, you tend to have positiveness. So if you think about something like legislation that would affect an industry or the country as a whole, the uncertainty about what will happen as we contemplate legislation gets priced into the market. And then as the legislation finalizes, it becomes quite clear that that's been priced and the uncertainty goes away. When you get to final legislation, it is what it is. And people hate losses more than they like gains. So in a world of uncertainty, you can contemplate more downside than you can contemplate upside. As the uncertainty fades away, you lose that fear of downside more relative to the potential opportunity of upside. And in politics, that's one of the reasons why both domestically and globally, gridlock has tended to be pretty good, because it makes for less legislative change. The way most people think, logically, is that what I believe is good and what somebody else believes that disagrees with me is bad. And while that might be true in ways that don't relate to the stock market or to capital markets, it might be true for the culture. It might be true for the economy in the long term. In the period that markets care about, the next 3 to 30 months, the uncertainty of my great ideas against your terrible ones or your great ones against my terrible ones as they're debated leads to uncertainty, leads to fear. People hate losses more than they like gains, and it leads to negativeness. And that's true whether it's a sector or for the economy as a whole. So what comes out of that is that gridlock tends to be good in the short term for markets. When you move to the back half of president's terms, when they typically are able to engage in less leadership of the country domestically in terms of the economy, that tends to be good. The back half of president's terms is overwhelmingly positive. There have only been 2 actual negative years in the history of the S&P 500 in the third year of a president's term ever. And those were, you know, way, way, way back in 1939 and 1931. And the reality of all of this is that simply, fundamentally, with the exception of what I had said earlier, which is non-political regulatory, where things can run amiss because we don't see them and they don't get discounted into pricing. When it comes to legislative, no matter what it is, the uncertainty is the biggest dilemma. And politicians, of course, are fundamentally, you can see this year probably as much or more than ever, combative. We typically don't believe them. We think they lie a lot. We can't easily tell who does and who doesn't. We always get a winner at the end, though. You take a year like this for president, we always get a winner. We always like the one we end up with more than we thought we would at the beginning of the process. That's true even if we don't like them. And that might not be true for you individually, but for our society it is. That takes the uncertainty away and it makes it a usually favorable outcome. But as I said earlier, that can be overridden by things that are totally non-political. But the political factor and the political cycle is discussed at great length in the book. And for the most part, action on the part of the government is bad because people hate losses more than they like gain.
In your book, you have a whole chapter. In fact, it's called Throw Away This Book. But you talk about some investment classics, many of which I read, which I thought was very helpful for a lot of readers out there, because there are a lot of investment books out there. But classics stand up because, I mean, you know, we still read Security Analysis. We still read The Intelligent Investor. Putting this into the book, what did you hope to accomplish with this?
Well, in my life, I've read an awful lot of investment books starting from when I was very young, and I've collected a lot of investment books. As I sit here now, I'm looking at hundreds of investment books that are here in front of my eyes. And I thought that it would be useful to readers who may not be able to calibrate getting away from some of those few that are the most famous to think about some of the maybe less famous ones that are older that you could still buy today easily online. Used to be, of course, it wasn't so easy to buy a used book. It was a harder thing to do. You couldn't just kind of go online and buy them. One of the advantages of the internet is you can find old books. So this takes people through older books, some of which are classics, but again, not so well known to people, like Where the Customer's Yacht by Schwed, which is a book from literally 75 years ago, or Steve Forbes' relatively newer book, How Capitalism Will Save Us. They break down into market books, economic books, and biographies about people that are important. For example, there's a book that I had from when I went to college called Radical Guide to Economic Reality by Angus Black, which is a spoof book. And literally, when I read that as a kid, about 1970, it literally flipped me on my head in no time at all. And I read it in anticipation of Angus Black, which was a pen name. His real name is Roger Leroy Miller. And he was coming to my campus to talk. And I read his book in anticipation of him coming to do the talk. And literally, he flipped my head around when I read the book a couple days before his talk, and then went to his talk, and took him no time at all to flip my brain around and make me think about things completely differently than I ever had. That's a useful activity for anybody.
Ken, you have a chapter in, I want to conclude here. How do you use the media? Because one of the things that we see in the media today, when any kind of event happens, whether it's a terrorist attack in Paris, whether it's a plunge in the markets on a single day, as we did the first trading day of the year, the media will dramatize and talk about it constantly, 24 hours around the clock. What do investors need to take away, and how can they use the media to their benefit?
So there's two basic points to this. The one point is, if it's widely broadcast and if it's about the next 3 months or longer than the next 30 months, you just ignore it. Hard as that may be often when some of this stuff is so tantalizing, you just ignore it. The media is mostly about things that, as it relates to markets, should not be any of your business. Then the other part is, because today we do have a much wider capability to gather information online with simple search engine optimization, etc., you want to look for credible sourcing of things that people aren't worrying about that are within the 3 to 30 month window. So our world today allows us access to information that we never used to have, much of which may be things that no one's talking about, no one's noticing. But the reality, as I said earlier in comment about the media in the beginning of our discussion, the media is almost solely understanding and representative of urban things. It's almost not at all understanding of non-urban things. If you cut America correctly, I believe America is about half and half. And the half of America that's non-urban, and this is largely true outside of America as well, but I think for your listeners, they can just focus on America to get the point. The media simply doesn't really understand, doesn't focus on, doesn't pay much attention, or misrepresents everything that's non-urban, and yet it's half of the country. So there's an awful lot that's out there today that you can understand and fathom. You can find information on via search that may be in the media, but nobody's talking about because the media is so myopically preoccupied with those things that gather eyeballs, which are the sensationalist things about the next 3 months right in front of our eyes or longer than 30 months out. And that's pretty much the conclusion of linking the time frame to the usage of the media.
So, Ken, if there was one point you would want your readers to walk away from after reading your book, what would that be?
Markets price all commonly known information, including what you think that's commonly known and what everybody else thinks is commonly known. And you need to make sure, as it relates to markets, that you think independently and that you think differently than the crowd. The book is not about beating the market. The book is about beating the crowd, who will do worse than the market by definition, because they will be the market less transaction costs. And they will make lots of active decisions at the wrong time. And what you need to do is remember that your job is not to beat the market. Your job is to beat the crowd. And that's not so hard to do, because the crowd is going to take off their own toes regularly. You need to make sure you don't take off your toes.
Well, Ken, I want to compliment you on a well-written book. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. The name of the book is called Beat the Crowd, How You Can Outvest the Herd by Thinking Differently, by Ken Fisher and Elizabeth Dellinger. Ken, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. A great book, and once again, my compliments.
Thanks for having me on, Jim. It's always great to talk to you.
Thank you.
I guess I always like contrarians, Jim, because I've been one all of my life. You know, it was ever since the days in school when somebody said, you can't do that. They didn't even think you could do it or you shouldn't do it. And the first thought is, oh no, watch me. You know, that was my first thought. But here you've got a guy, Ken Fisher, who's a billionaire investor, and he's made quite a bit of money on the basis of just not following the herd and making his own decisions.
Yeah. And just to add a little color to Ken's father, Phil Fisher, wrote a book, Common Stocks, Uncommon Profits, or I get those titles messed up. But anyway, that book was very influential next to Ben Graham in Warren Buffett's career. Warren Buffett cites Ken's father, Phil Fisher, as having a major influence on his investment thinking in terms of evaluating growth stocks. And so if you look at Warren Buffett today, he's kind of a combination of those, well, actually three, you know, Ben Graham, Phil Fisher, and Charlie Munger, if you want to understand Warren Buffett. So Ken was able to use his father's principle plus his own investment acumen in terms of also evaluating the media to become a billionaire. A great book, by the way. I highly recommend it. I really enjoyed reading Ken's book because it points to so many things that we see that go on with the media, how they're always driving us from either crisis to euphoria. It's one of those two. But anyway, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.